If you watched a movie with Shia LaBeouf and Michelle Monaghan, you watched the wrong movie. Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
What you witnessed today with your coffee and biscuits is terrible. What these men would have done would have been even more terrible. Never tell a soldier that he does not know the cost of war.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 101. Today's big recommend is Eye in the Sky, Looking at You. I'm joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hi, Dilly Ho, Cinerinos.
And Jeremy Scott.
Hello.
And once again, welcome, chat. Glad you've come out here on a Tuesday to watch us talk about movies and things of that nature. Do you guys have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I had a friend in college. Every time we played role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons, he would play that Eye in the Sky song first, and we had to listen to the whole game, and then we would start. It was awesome.
That's fun.
I happened to catch on Netflix with my wife a couple weeks ago, Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget. This is an unexpected sequel to Chicken Run. If for some reason you are anti-Mel Gibson, know that he is not in this film. He's been replaced by Zachary Levi. I'm not sure if it was because he was Mel Gibson or it was just been 20 years. I don't know. But we've got Attendee Newton, Bella Ramsey, and that looks like all the names I really recognize. But this takes place after the first movie, obviously, and they have moved to this island on a lake where they live happily ever after, because apparently humans don't ever boat and go to the islands on a lake, which I would certainly do. And they have a kid. This is the titular nugget. They have a child. And the child decides to go leave the island and explore the world, makes a friend, ends up in a chicken truck that's going to a chicken nugget producing facility. Where they put collars on the chickens that make them really stupid, because chickens that don't have fear taste better. I am not convinced this is quite as good as the first one, but it's Aardman. So there's always bits of magic. And there is a visual gag in this movie when they are trying to break in to this high-tech facility that is one of the best gags I have ever seen in my entire life. I paused the movie. I was laughing so hard at this gag. And I don't want to tell you what it is, but it involves a security eye scan. And I am shocked nobody has ever thought to do this gag before. It was so funny. It makes the whole movie for me. But I think there's plenty of other smiles and laughs here for you. If you enjoy Chicken Run, if you enjoy the Aardman stuff, I think you're going to have a really good time with Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget.
I had been hearing about this sequel for so long that I'm shocked that it's out. it feels like it's been like 2 or 3 years. It feels like that I first heard about the sequel to this. So I'll need to see that. I like the first Chicken Run. So
yeah, I would not go into this expecting the first Chicken Run, which I think is an all-timer. I think that movie is just incredible. But it is a ton of fun. I back everything Jeremy said. This is a lot of fun, especially after the first 15, 20 minutes. Like, it takes a little bit of exposition and stuff to get going, and then it's just like it's a ton of fun.
It reminded me weirdly of Muppets from Space. What is the Muppet Space one where Gonzo gets kidnapped and they have to go to this high-tech facility to rescue him? Anyway, Jeffrey Tambor's.
I think that is Muppets from Space, isn't it?
It's Muppets from Space.
Yeah. Pigs in Space! Mm-hmm. All right.
Let's see. I guess it's my turn. I'm going to do a small recommend for a TV show that is been running in the UK for 16 series. It is called Taskmaster. They do two series a year. And the series started off at 5 episodes. They are now 10 episodes a series. This is Greg Davies, a great comedian from the UK, and Alex Holm is his co-host. And they make this show. Their banter, the way they play off of each other, and the fact that it's a British-style panel show, which we don't really have a lot of these that rise to prominence in America, where you basically just every season, it's a different set of comedians or funny celebrities or whatever that are just a part of the show. And because everybody on the show is so, has such a great sense of humor, is so clever, that like you just can't help but have these amazing, fun, hilarious moments that happen. Now, the conceit of the show is that each of these people are given the same task. So let's say the task is to, fit this stuffed camel through the smallest hole possible. And then they are left to determine, how can I do that? What are the rules? Those kind of things. So somebody will just look for, you know, the opening between the oven door and the oven and try to, you know, squeeze it through there. Somebody else will cut the camel entirely apart and try to squeeze it through, you know, a straw. Somebody else will try to blend the camel with water and pour it through something, you know, like, so it's just a matter of, there's this cleverness to it where you also are going, oh, how would I best accomplish this task? And then there's just the fun and the hilarity. And we started watching this. It is available on YouTube. There's an official Taskmaster channel here in America. Because we're not in the UK, you can watch all the full episodes of every single series is available on YouTube. And it's in very convenient season playlists. So it was very easy just to let it run. It's a fun thing to just let run while you're working on whatever and just kind of tuning in. So we had a great time this past weekend. We watched the first 5 series of this show and just laughed and laughed and laughed and had a good time. So
between that and that Only Connect show that I was talking about several months ago, I get the sense that this is all British television. It's all like all their shows are funny people commenting and being funny while doing mundane things.
And they jump from show to show.
I'm sure they do.
You'll see the same people on Taskmaster and then they'll jump over to
Wild is we had this with Hollywood Squares, but it just wasn't ever as consistently funny as this British stuff that I've seen. And it turned into I don't know what it turned into, but it wasn't funny by the end.
They attempted an American version of the show. They did one season and it completely tanked and apparently no one watched it. And my brother, who introduced me to the show, said that they just didn't understand the tone. He tried to watch some of it and he said it just didn't understand how it was supposed to work. But anyways, Taskmaster is a blast. I recommend
Taskmaster. Blastmaster.
All right. A few episodes ago, I recommended Mr. Ballin, the YouTube channel, and I had heard this story through Mr. Ballin before Netflix made a docuseries about it. It's American Nightmare. This is a 3-episode mini doc basically. They should have just made this a 2-hour movie, but I guess Netflix is always like, we got to break it up, we got to make episodes out of it. But the premise of this is going to be familiar to a lot of you who ever follow true crime stories and things of that nature. A man by the name of Aaron Quinn calls the police and says, my girlfriend has been kidnapped. And I have a ransom and blah, blah, blah that I have to pay and all this other stuff. But it had been hours after the alleged kidnapping had even happened. And so most of you who have ever heard this kind of story before are going to immediately be like, oh, yeah, boyfriend killed his girlfriend. And then now the cops are going to have to find her. And so, this is one of those series, though, that to tell you any more at this point is to ruin some of the just like absolute ridiculousness that this story involves. Now, it's also also a tragic story, and I want to warn some viewers that there is some trigger stuff in here. concerning events that happen in this, and you may want to check up on that before you watch it. But and Netflix does a pretty good job before the episodes telling you what you're about to hear. This is one of those you've never heard this before. The story of this is one of those that's just, it's so out there that it really, it's really one of those stranger than fiction type of stories. So I would highly recommend this, especially if you are a true crime person, because this has so many twists in it that it's just absolutely insane.
My wife watched this all in one day. I think it's like three episodes. And I came in, you know, periodically and watched bits and pieces of it. And I can attest that at times it felt like I was watching an entirely different documentary in terms of what had happened since the last time I was in the room. And yeah, it's an insane story, and she really enjoyed it. So I will,
and my wife will back this up. And one thing I can say about this is that one thing that this does is that, you know, I understand the position of the cops in this, because they've heard these stories a million times. So they're obviously going to be, you know, they're going to have certain biases about these type of things, but it's terrible if you're in this kind of situation and you just cannot say anything that sounds reasonable whatsoever. Right. And you're always going to be hounded by the people in charge of the investigation about it. So anyway, highly recommend. We'll go on to the big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Which is Eye in the Sky, Jeremy's choice. So take it away, Jeremy.
I am the eye in the sky. I like this movie. I think this is a thinker, and it's very Gone Baby Gone, in that I believe viewers can find themselves on either side of the central argument at various points throughout the movie. But we open with a quote from a man I'd never heard of and whose name I can't pronounce. I believe it's Astrakleth. I don't know. But he says, in truth, or in war, truth is the first casualty. And that, that feels very true and very timely today. Then we go straight to Nairobi, and we meet a family that's starting their day, and mom is baking bread, and father is repairing a hula hoop for the daughter. The daughter's name is Aaliyah. And I think throughout my notes, I start referring to her as that. And then we pan up, pull back, and get a sense of the whole neighborhood that they're in. It's obviously not America. I'm not sure if the screen says we're in Nairobi at that point, or if we just find out later through dialogue. And in a moment, I want to point out, we do see the father hide some school books when a customer comes to have the bike fixed. Then we move around a lot here in the beginning of this movie. Then we move over to meet Helen Mirren, who lives with a snoring husband, yet still sleeps in the same bed with him for some reason. and she starts her day super early, before sunrise. And we see her exit the house and go to a finished garage that kind of looks like a military office, where she gets an email that one of her operatives in Nairobi has been killed by local militants. Then we jump to Vegas at 8 p.m. as Aaron Paul's alarm is going off, which, imagine, night shift just sucks, man. I've done it a couple of times. It just sucks. He heads into work, and he's a drone pilot. And before we can learn more about him, we jump back to Helen Mirren, and we see her entering a super secure British military command center. And she calls Alan Rickman on the phone, and he is the general that is directly over her. Then Aaron Paul gets to work, and we get our first convergence of these stories, where Helen Mirren's Colonel Powell gives them a digital briefing message for the mission. And the mission is to use a drone to monitor this house in Nairobi, where they suspect some terrorists are going to meet. She quite crucially says, this is a mission to capture, not kill. Your job is to be their eye in the sky. And then the credits roll and the movie is over. we then get a little bit of a look at the assets they have on the ground. There is a hummingbird-like camera surveilling this house. And they have a couple of agents manning a van nearby. And we also get back to Aaliyah, and her mom's bread is done being cooked. And so they send her out, and she sets up a table to sell the bread. We then cut to the general, who's in a toy store. This is Alan Rickman. I don't remember his character's name. I'll just call him the general. He's the only general in the movie. And he's shopping for a doll for presumably his granddaughter, could be his daughter. I'm not sure they explicitly say, but he buys a Time to Sleep doll when he was supposed to buy the Baby Moves doll. So he sends an underling out to exchange the dolls and then sits down with a few people in suits and prepares to go after the day's mission. But then suddenly there are two new terrorist recruits that they are tracking that are brought outside this house they're surveilling with a woman. And the woman drives them away. They can't completely ID the woman, but they believe it to be a woman named Danford, who is a British national, wife of a top terrorist target. So they have the drone follow that car, which leads to the home of an arms dealer in a restricted neighborhood that is apparently controlled by the militia. So they decide to have one of the on-site van agents go on foot near the arms dealer's house to surveil with a Beetle drone, which has a limited range, but that will put that operative in danger because he is now out on the streets instead of in the van. We do see Aaliyah later being scolded for playing in front of a customer, and her father says, these people around us are fanatics, and you should only play when it's just the family around, which she says now, and he said yes. And then we watch the two drone pilots, Steve and Carrie, back in Vegas, and they watch Aaliyah dance in the hula hoop and smile. The British ministers debate killing Danford, but it's rejected. Then they find out her husband is also in there and order the Beetle Cam to check out the other rooms of the house. It is at this point they discover someone in a bedroom building suicide vests, and a discussion is had to consider upping the rules of engagement from capture to kill. That will be the central conflict for the rest of the film. Legal tells Powell to refer up to the Attorney General. This is going to be a common theme, by the way. And a debate begins inside the general's office because the Attorney General is in there. The lone female official asks, has there ever been a British drone strike on a friendly country that is not at war? And they all fall silent, basically letting you know, no, there hasn't been. As they continue to debate, Powell calls the pilot of the drone herself, that's Steve, to try and persuade him to be on her side. But he asks if the U.S. government knows that there is a U.S. citizen in this house. And she says that they do. He doesn't seem very convinced. But he and his co-pilot begin preparing the drone to be ready to fire the Hellfire missiles. Back to the boardroom, one of the ministers exercises his right to refer up to his boss, the foreign minister. This frustrates both the general and Colonel Powell, who want to fire the missile now. they hate the red tape. It takes a bit, but once they track down the Game of Thrones foreign minister guy, he won't say yes to the strike without the U.S. Secretary of State's authorization. They track that guy down in Beijing at a table tennis event, and he unequivocally supports the strike. Very, very American, this guy. The order goes down the line, but before the missile can be fired, more bread is done baking, and Aaliyah returns to the table in the street, which we find out is right outside this terrorist target house. So Steve, the pilot, stops the launch by doing basically the only thing he can in this position. As the person releasing the weapon, he calls for a new collateral damage estimate, considering that the girl is now there selling bread. Now, in my opinion, all he's doing here is buying time. I don't think he expects anything from a collateral damage estimate to change the minds of his superiors. I think he's just hoping someone will buy the bread by the time it takes them to make that decision. Powell asks the Beetle drone operator to literally go buy all the bread from Aaliyah so that she'll leave. This is pretty clever and a very low-tech solution, but it's super unsafe for him to be out there. And as he's buying all the bread, he's recognized by one of the militia members. He throws the bread at the guy and makes a run for it, and then gets insanely lucky in that he is able to hide under a lifted truck on blocks, and they don't find him. And yeah, I found that pretty lucky, but
very Taken Three.
Yes, Taken Three. But the girl has, Aaliyah has picked up the bread and is going to sell all that again because she's super smart, yo. Like, she's going to make double on this bread. She already got his money. Anyway, this sets off a new bout of legal debates as to whether or not the mission is still legal. The British Attorney General says something to the effect of, this is actually a great line. It's one thing to fire the missile while the street is empty and hope that it remains that way until the missile hits. It's something else entirely to know this girl will at worst be fatally injured and at best be seriously injured. A lot more back and forth, and Sir Jorah of food poisoning punts and tells them that they need clearance from the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister says, do whatever you can to minimize casualties, which is essentially a bureaucrat's way of saying, I'm not taking the blame for any of this. Meanwhile, Colonel Powell asks for a recalculation of the collateral damage estimate if they were to target the missile to a different point of the house. And she basically steamrolls this underling guy into giving her a 45% casualty for the girl if they move the missile to the other side of the house. I don't think it's explicitly stated, but I got the impression that that's not true and that she basically said, hey, I'm your superior. Give me what I want.
Yeah.
It's pretty uncomfortable to watch. The Beetle Drone guy comes out of hiding and still on the good team. Gives some money to a kid kicking a ball and says, go buy this girl's bread a few blocks away. Buy it all and I'll give you all this money. And we intercut with Steve, the pilot, Carrie, the co-pilot, running down their checklist for missile launch. They see the boy run up, buy the bread and run off. But the girl doesn't make it away before the explosion. And she's seen lying in the street. She does move a little bit. But they have to move the camera to go ID the bodies of the terrorists to make sure that they killed them. One of them is still alive and moving. So they immediately decide to fire another missile. Aaliyah's father comes out and finds her, mother right behind him, and the second missile hits. Father picks up Aaliyah, begs an approaching militant vehicle, and the soldiers have a moment of compassion, remove the gun from the back of their vehicle, and put the girl and her parents in there and rush them to the hospital. Before the general leaves the boardroom, the lady minister scolds him for a disgraceful mission. And he snaps back with a nice little speech, essentially ending with never tell a soldier that he does not know the cost of war. He leaves and we see his underling hand him the doll and he walks down the hall. And I love and am disturbed by the cutting from the general going home with his dolly to the girl in the hospital dying. And then we get Powell driving home in the rain. She doesn't seem super bothered. Steve and Carrie, super bothered, being coldly told by their boss, need you back in 12 hours. And then the closing credits, reveal what the movie's main point is as we see Aaliyah dancing in slow motion with the hula hoop before the credits roll. The end, Eye in the Sky. If you watched a movie with Shia LaBeouf and Michelle Monaghan, you watched the wrong movie. What did you guys think of Eye in the Sky?
Yes, I did. I was looking for Eagle Eye everywhere when you mentioned this. Okay, so yeah, I've been thinking about this movie for quite some time since I watched it. I think it was presented as a sort of trolley problem, but it's a different kind of trolley problem because instead of you knowing that there's five people on one track and one on the other track, there's sort of a cloudy haze where those five people are, and there is definitely one person on the one track. So I found myself for a while, and I don't know where I've ended up, but I was on the side of that woman inside the room with Jeremy Northam and Alan Rickman, who kept saying, no, you shouldn't do this because, you know, the collateral damage, the innocent lives that are going to be lost is not worth doing this. And of course, the argument being that the suicide bombers are going to do way more damage than we ever will. And I kept thinking about this, like, okay, so that is obviously a really difficult problem to work out. Like, do we, since we're going to kill this one innocent person trying to, or many innocent people trying to kill these three very bad people or whatever, five, I guess was total in that house. But, they're going to kill so much more and whatever. Oh my God, man. I was like, the things that they have in this movie, I know that there's a tremendously complex political structure going on here because we have Kenyan forces, we have Americans doing the drone, it's a British operation. Yep. They have to keep going to the higher ups and talking to, you know, and to lawyers and all this other stuff. There's all this red tape you gotta go through to do this kind of thing. But as I was looking at all the technology they had in this movie, I was like, man, don't you have any way of doing this without killing innocent people? That's what I was sitting there thinking the whole time. And I understand that there's a big political reality here that they've set But man, with all the stuff that I saw that they had under their command, I was like, this is just fucking evil to blow up a house with, you know, with innocent people around just because you've been waiting 6 years to get these people and you're just like tired of it, basically, is what it's come down to. But you've had all this intelligence about the meeting itself and who's going to be there and all that. You can't find a better time to do. Now, Alan Rickman does his level best at the very end with that quote saying, "Do never tell a soldier the cost of war," and all that, and especially in the way he could have been the most evilest person in this movie, and I've been like, yeah, you know what, you're right. don't tell a soldier the cost of war, man. He's so good. I really like this movie. I'm gonna say, though, I nearly started laughing at how many times something would happen where it would change the course of things. And oh, we'll buy the bread. And then he buys it. Oh, I know who this person is. I kicked him out of here once. And then he throws the bread at the guy and then he runs off. And then they're like, okay, well, that's cool. Well, at least the girl's not selling the bread anymore. And then she goes and gathers up the bread and puts it back on the table to double dip. And then it's like, oh, well, he got that kid to buy the bread. All right, she's done. And there's 30 seconds. Get out of there. And she's like, eh, I'll take my time taking this blanket off the table and, you know, all this stuff. If you guys ever watched Mr. Show back in the day, there is a sketch where like a guy comes into a small store and asks for change for a dollar. And the guy behind the counter is so handcuffed by not being able to make his own decisions that he goes and calls his boss. And then his boss has to call his boss. And his boss calls his boss. And it gets all the way to the president of the United States by the end of it. That's what's so funny. Every time somebody brings something up, there's a point where Aaron Paul is like, I need a new collateral damage assessment on this thing. And here you can see the look on Helen Mirren's face like, God damn it. What do we have to do to shoot this missile already? And it's a very serious, and I know that these guys have to deal with this kind of decision every day, but which is sad to think about every day, because you know, by the end of it, they're like, they tell Aaron Paul and the woman from The Great, who's Elle Fanning's friend in The Great, they tell them, be back in 12 hours. It's like, no, it's just kind of like how short-term 12 ended last week almost.
Yeah, you know, we'll start all over again.
The cycle just happens again and again. But I really, really enjoyed this. This is another one of those. You got a lot of like just heavy hitters in here, a lot of good actors. The situation at first is, you know, the situation isn't complex at all. There's no suicide bombers at all. And I was like wondering what is the debate here? Like she wanted to strike before the suicide bombers even popped. So, but then they show that up and then that's where you start having to think, okay, what would I do in this situation? And I think it's something well worth mulling over. And, I really enjoyed it. I really liked it.
You say before you go, Aaron, you say something about nearly laughing. There's a moment I marked where near the end where Jeremy Northam says the legal argument is that we could wait. We need not wait. And the military argument is that we should not wait. And the other guy goes, exactly. And I wrote, it's almost Abbott and Costello at that moment. There is a version of this movie, if Inarucci made it, that could be a comedy. And I don't mean to make light of what happens in this movie.
I was thinking this exact thing. If this was an Iannucci thing, this would have been a comedy, and he would have written some very biting, cutting and severe dialogue in this thing.
Yeah.
But it's razor thin. Like, as serious as this movie is, there's an element to it that's like, oh, come on.
You know,
that gets to you. So,
yeah. Okay. Sorry to cut you off, Aaron. Go ahead.
No, you're good. It really is. It's not a comedy of errors. It's a tragedy of errors. You know, like it's kind of the same feel of what we're used to seeing with those kind of comedies where, and another thing has gone wrong. So, yeah, I totally felt that same thing. I love this movie. I think this is a, an extremely well-crafted movie. And I want to start there. There's, believe me, plenty I want to talk about with the philosophical stuff, with the conundrum stuff. I love that kind of discussion. But even beyond that, the technical nature of this movie is so cool for a few reasons. Number one, the juxtapositions this movie makes on a consistent basis are really, really smart. The movie starts with two different types of unawareness. One is a little girl dancing in a hula hoop in her own yard, completely oblivious and unaware that there is evil right around the corner and that a missile is coming, whatever. And then it cuts to, I believe, Helen Mirren in bed with her significant other, whatever, and he is snoring, completely oblivious to the decision she's going to have to make, you know, later on in the day, and kind of a representation for most of us. Just kind of sleeping and snoring and going on with our day-to-day lives, completely not having to worry that there are people with their hands on triggers making decisions that cost lives. Like, that's, you know, just something we don't think about, that we don't have to worry about. And I love that this movie does that over and over and over again. The way it portrays these characters, for instance, the American Secretary of State, he is very specifically and purposefully at a table tennis match, at a ping pong match, because he is just volleying it back to them. He's like, what are you doing? I don't need, like, the places this movie puts its characters are representative of who they are. The foreign secretary who is indisposed because of intestinal issues. Yeah. He is a weak man. He is sickly. He doesn't know how to make this decision. Like, it's really smart about how it makes its characters almost a metaphor for themselves throughout. And it does those kind, even the Rickman character with the dog. Choice, you know, is kind of a commentary on how his real life is so separate from, you know, this, and how he's able to compartmentalize and go, okay, you know, it's a math equation for me. This is how it works. And I really love that the movie is smart like that. Because I think that really helps on a subconscious level, if not a conscious one. I think there is an interesting question that this movie asks on both sides that is part of the conundrum that I don't think we've talked about quite a bit yet, which is the age of the potential innocent victim. There is this idea of, because it's a little girl, it's like, what else? Maybe have her holding a puppy? That's the only way we get to a more, like, how can you let this happen kind of thing. If that's a middle-aged man, are we feeling the same feelings? And how do we feel about the fact that we're not for the middle-aged man who is also innocent, unaware, and, you know, like, how does our perspective change when we think of the cost of life?
And by the way, sorry to interject but this was a part of the movie that I was actually thinking about a lot, was we're worried about this one girl, and there's probably other children elsewhere that we're not even seeing in the frame. And then there's other people, other innocent people that are in there, and we're not worried about them whatsoever. And that's what I kept coming back to, and the going for the 45%, you know, damage assessment and everything. I was like, oh my God, guys, we're just deciding that these lives really don't matter whatsoever. So anyway,
One of the other technical things I really love, I love the soundtrack in this. I love how there's this thrumming digital pressure that's happening underneath the music, and then on top are these Middle Eastern instruments that are playing a different melody. Like, it's a really interesting thing that they're doing with this. The background score in this movie as well. I love the way this movie gives us insight into modern warfare, into modern technology, and how that impacts things. I do think the technology in this, without being an expert, feels a little futuristic to me. Do we, like, those Beatles, especially in 2008, like, that seems, I don't know, if you have those, what else do you need? What other surveillance do you need? It's
2015,
wild.
Not 2008.
But sorry, 2015. My bad.
It's what's fascinating is that it does feel futuristic, but not that far out of reach, because we are making tinier and tinier drones. It feels plausible to me.
The machinery nerd, so of I the Googled little wings.
There are not hummingbirds in Kenya. I Googled that. And so that camera should stand out more than it does.
But, and why do you have to be closer for the bug than the hummingbird? Like the
smaller, so it has a smaller battery.
Oh,
I don't know. It's
the battery. Okay, okay, that's fine. We're not doing this. That's fine.
It's cool, Aaron. It's cool tech.
It is really cool tech. It is super cool tech. But I do like the stuff that you can imagine even more than that, that is actual idea of how warfare has changed. That it's two people sitting in a shed in the middle of the desert in America that are, you know, actually playing a real-life video game that has real-life consequences, and that is modern warfare. And it's not you know, enlisting tens of thousands of humans to go march on a beach, you know, like it's completely different.
Well, I think that what's fascinating to me about those little shacks is that they are laid out exactly like a cockpit. Like we're going to make you feel like you're in a plane, even though you're in a shack. And then one thing the movie does just a couple of times is give us a sense of scale. There are dozens of those shacks. We're just seeing one story with one pilot and his direct commanding officer. But they're not the only drone pilots. There's a bunch of them out there in those buildings probably having the same dilemma.
Chris, I was glad you mentioned Rickman's performance. I think he's so good here. I too... Even as a very staunch pacifist, which I should mention that makes the conundrum here a little different for me. I pacifism is something I have grown into over my years in a very real way. And even as a staunch pacifist, you listen to Rickman talk about the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few, and you're just going, Alan, kill people. Go ahead, kill people. Yeah. I'm with you. And it's really convincing. And I think there is something in us that does the math, that likes to do the math. And that's why the conundrum is interesting, because we think of it as a simple math problem. We think of it as, you know, yes, this one little girl dies, but it saves that suicide vest from, you know, killing hundreds. But what we don't think of in this trolley problem is that if you take out the trolley that has, you know, one person, in this trolley problem, that trolley then has five or six other trolleys that then get radicalized to go back. And then that creates 10 trolleys that come back the other way, which creates 20 trolleys that go back the other. So like, you know, this in this kind of moral conundrum, at least from my pacifistic point of view, you don't realize you're creating more violence, even with what you think is minimizing violence.
That is like they briefly mentioned this conundrum in the movie. And that's the part that you can't possibly know in this is how many people look at this and go, oh, my brother was killed in this American drone attack, and there's nobody here for me, and I'm under the rule of this militia here or whatever. I'm angry. I'm ready to, you know, to get back at those did so much to my life and everything. And that is another thing, right? Like, yes, you may have only killed 25 people other than the ones that you intended to, but now you've created an exponential problem with other people getting radicalized and going off and doing stuff and killing thousands, tens of thousands more or whatever. So
yeah violence begets violence. It's, you know, and it doesn't matter if that violence is, you think, the lesser of two violences. You're still committing violence, which then creates the exponential increase of more violence. So yeah, it is a conundrum. And like I said, I can find my way to empathy for all of the views that people are espousing, but I've just come to a conclusion in my life that, you know, wherever that line is for others, for me, it's, you know, I will not.
So now, everybody, violence. If you ever meet Aaron, you can slap him across the face as many times as you want, and he will not do anything.
That's the moral of this podcast.
That's the lesson you should take. I think amongst anything else, that's the lesson you should take.
Yeah,
I hear pacifism and immediately go to violence.
Okay, well, time for the super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, what did you come up with?
I went with a movie that I think checks the most boxes for the things that I found in this movie. It is the reason 2008 was in my brain, I believe, because I think this is 2008. I went with Body of Lies.
Ooh, wow.
This is Russell Crowe, Leonardo DiCaprio. I believe it's a Ridley Scott film. The film is a little more inert than it should be. I wish this movie were like a little better. The tension here doesn't quite work through the entire thing, but it deals with a lot of the same, because Russell Crowe is doing this from a distance. Leonardo is the person on the ground. In fact, this movie also starts with an opening quote. This one actually dealing with the conundrum that we were just talking about. Which is, I and the public know what all school children learn. Those whom evil is done do evil in return. And it really deals with those conundrum issues of the ideas of violence begets violence. How do you deal with, you know, stopping violence without being violent? This is a little more action-y than Eye in the Sky, for sure. Like, it wants, I mean, it's Ridley Scott, so it wants to go for that. But I think a lot of the technology is there. There's a lot of drone shots in this movie. It's Oscar Isaac's first big role, by the way, which, you know, I actually watched a little bit of this again last night to kind of refresh myself on it. And it was interesting seeing Oscar Isaac. The first time I watched this, I'd had no clue who he was. And so, yeah, Body of Lies would be, I think, a good double feature with Eye in the Sky.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
The whole thing about the drone shooting the missile and trying to get the proper target for a meeting reminded me of Clear and Present Danger the most out of all this. Now, Clear and Present Danger is not exactly like this. There's not a lot of decisions being made like this movie or anything, but the bombing of that house is a central part of that. Of that movie, and you know, it's planning on a drug cartel meeting happening at this house. The missile gets shot, but there's nobody that they want to kill is in the house. They haven't arrived yet, and then that leads to Joaquin D'Alameda going in and like trying to figure out. There's a great scene in Clear and Present Danger where both he and Harrison Ford as Jack Ryan are at their various command posts trying to figure out who shot this missile and finding out that there's no bomb fragments and all this other stuff. And like, they both come to the same conclusion that, you know, that this was an illegal shot or whatever. That's what it reminded me of. I thought of also Zero Dark 30, just because of the tactical things that are going on in this movie. Jessica Chastain is essentially the Helen Mirren, although maybe not. I don't know. She's probably just as bloodthirsty as Helen Mirren in this movie. But Jessica Chastain's been trying to do this for years in this movie. Can't get anybody to bite on her intel whatsoever. And that was another one that I thought of.
I almost brought it up in conversation, but I was scared one of you picked it. But this movie made me think about Minority Report in terms of stopping crime before it happens and the morality of that.
Yeah, that's a good one. A really good one.
All right, next week's big recommend, I believe it falls to Chris this week. What you got for us?
It does. Okay, boy. As I said, man, once this starts getting into like decades where I've actually watched a ton of movies, this is going to start getting harder and harder and harder. So I have, now we're in the 1980s comedies. There are a lot of great comedies in the 1980s. There's also a lot of comedies that were inspired by Animal House. And of course they're just awful. There's a lot of beach comedies that came out during these years. There are a handful of comedies that I feel like not very many people talk about, and this would have been a perfect time for Top Secret. Of course, we've already done Top Secret. But I mulled over many movies like I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, and The Burbs, and A Fish Called Wanda, it must have been like 10 that I was shuffling through. I ended up on another Zucker Brothers Abrams production, and that is Ruthless People. This is probably their only like non slapstick, non parody movies that they ever made. And but I love this. This is one of those movies where I love the premise immediately. From the very beginning, Danny DeVito, we know that he hates his wife, wants to kill his wife, played by Bette Midler. And he's about to go and do the deed, But then two people kidnap her and tell him that if he doesn't pay like an extravagant ransom of some sort, they're going to kill her. And if you contact the cops or the media, we're going to kill her. And the very next scene is a bunch of cops and media coming up to the door. And this is a ton of people in this movie. Judge Reinhold. You have Judge Reinhold. You have Helen Slater, Supergirl for a lot of you out there. You have Bill Pullman in his first role, I believe, is in this movie. This is one where just like it's like every it's the plotting of it, the decisions that the characters have to make and what people know and what they don't know turns into a nice farcical situation, and I think a lot of people will like it. Now, unfortunately, this is a movie that you can only rent from services, and I don't know if there's a free service anywhere that plays it in your area, but you can go to the usual places.
All right. Excellent. Ruthless People. I haven't seen this in 35 years.
Yes.
I believe I told you guys in the Slack, I don't remember anything about it. So it would be like going in for the first time. So, excellent. Excellent. I believe we have time for a couple of questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Movie you love. This is not a properly grammar phrased question. Movie you love with a score you hate, or movie you hate with a score you love?
Man, I tell you what. They came out with that re-release of The Abyss that came out in theaters, and I went to watch it. I had not seen it since it was released.
Oh, wow.
And back in the day, I did not like this movie. So I gave it, a 30 plus years to maybe now that I'm in a different place, I can watch The Abyss and enjoy it. I did not enjoy The Abyss whatsoever, but I'll tell you what, the Alan Silvestri score that's in it is fucking awesome. And every time that I hear the score in that movie, I'm like, oh, I'm watching a really good movie, and I didn't like it. So that's going to be my answer.
I like it. Aaron?
That is a great answer. I have a movie that I despise. In fact, it may be the movie I hate the most of all movies ever made, and it has an amazing score. It is M. Night Shyamalan's The Last Airbender. The score to that movie is actually really, really good. But I despise that movie for many reasons, so it's my go-to answer for this question.
Did Newton Howard do that one?
I believe so. I was just trying to look it up to confirm, but yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have a good answer here, but I went with The Sting 2, which I remember being terrible. I love The Sting. But I love ragtime music, and so they just kept that theme in the sequel. Like The Entertainer and all those songs from The Sting.
I've never seen The Sting 2.
Oh, it's bad.
I've never seen it.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Well, that's because you don't have any of the principles in it. Nobody returned. They just wrote a whole new story. Anyway, that was my answer. I think it's interesting that we all went the love route, didn't we? We love the score, but hate the movie. We couldn't. Right. The question gave us the option to answer in reverse, but
I could not think of a movie I love with a bad score, which is an interesting thing to say.
Just off the top of my head, the movie GoldenEye is really good, and the score is atrocious in that movie. They're trying to do some like electronic, like up to date kind of thing, and it's fucking bad, man. It's terrible. Oh, it's no good.
I bet you could go back to a lot of 80s movies that are good, and the score is going to be that Casio keyboard.
Yeah.
I've been watching a lot of movies in the late 80s, early 90s recently, and it was a thing. And you go back, and it feels, the melodrama in the score just feels so real. And it's like, is this parody? I don't think they mean it to be parody. Yeah. So, yeah, right. That's probably a good answer.
It existed perfectly in just a very tiny window and then became parody of itself.
Yeah.
All right, let's do another one. You have the opportunity to show the entire world two movies, one for reasons of entertainment, one for enlightenment purposes. What movies are you choosing?
Mine are very, very basic. I mean, I'm going to show people Back to the Future for entertainment purposes. I don't know if there's one movie that just appeals to so many people like that movie does. It's got everything in it, you know, comedy, action, great performances, all of that. I think it's the perfect kind of entertainment movie. For the enlightenment purposes, I'm going to show Schindler's List. I don't know if there's a more, one of the more heartbreaking scenes in that movie is when they go in and raid the ghettos, and Ralph Fiennes says that this community was responsible for all this amazing history and art and everything, and that ends here today, is what he says. That whole movie is heartbreaking, of course, but I think that one would be my enlightenment pick.
I, like Chris, have chosen my favorite movie of all time for the entertainment one. Singing in the Rain I just think a joyful, fun thing to watch from beginning to end, and translates to a lot of different people. So yeah, I would go with Singing in the Rain. The enlightenment purposes may be a surprise to some. I went with Soul. Pixar's Soul. I think the things this movie has to say about the value of life are deeper and more interesting than people give it credit for. There are some really, really deep and interesting philosophical meanderings going on in this movie under the guise of comedy and animation. And it doesn't surprise me. I could have gone with Inside Out for that matter. You know, like Pete Docter just does this. Mm-hmm. But Soul, I think can speak to that central core of what it means to value life. Why is life valuable? What does it mean? So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to entertain because I'm assuming we're going to the big screen, and I want to show people Untouchables. Because even though I don't quote that as my favorite movie, it may be the most entertaining film I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And then for enlightenment, I'm going back to my bullshit with Roma, because that movie made me think about my life different, and maybe it could do the same for somebody else. I don't know.
Over in the chat, we have Todd Haynes, Wonderstruck for both entertainment and enlightenment. I have not seen that movie, so I can't decide whether that's a good choice or not, but I'm going to assume that it is. Castro says Everything Everywhere All at Once. That is a perfect choice.
Yep, I have
obviously seen that movie, and that does fit both. Nick says Entertainment, Dungeons and Dragons, Enlightenment, Zone of Interest. Yeah. Some good choices there in the chat as well. Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Next week's movie is Ruthless People. Once again, chat, thank you so much for coming out and watching us today. We love you guys for coming out. And look at everybody doing the Taylor Swift hearts, except for me. I'll bow out on that one. That's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time. See ya.
Goodbye, everybody.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
As the Kool-Aid man would say,
oh yeah.
Sounds a little bit like Savage. What's Macho Man?
That's right.
It does sound like that. I wonder if there's any connection whatsoever.
Conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
Macho Man Savage voiced the Kool-Aid man.
There's something going on, something shady.
Something shady. Why wouldn't they tell us that Randy Macho Man Savage voiced the Kool-Aid man? Huh, Chris? Why wouldn't they tell us that?
They were covering up a deep, dark secret about flat Earth is what they were doing.
It's probably true.
I kind of want to back away from this, whatever conversation you're having right now.
That's not a shock.
No, I think all three of us are slowly backing away.
You could be talking about so many different things. Like I just walked in. You're like, conspiracy, you have no information, make up shit. Like, I had a dozen different things go through my head.
Was Taylor Swift one of them in the Chiefs? Yeah.
Not the Chiefs. No, I just read this article that she's suing the kid that tracks private planes, and it pissed me off. There's a kid that tracks private planes, which is publicly available information.
Correct.
And she is suing him because she doesn't like the fact that he points out that she's a hypocrite when it comes to climate change, and she flies her private jet around empty all the time. So now between her and Justin Timberlake, I'm losing people that I like this week.
You do have a really horrible situation, though, if you're Taylor Swift, right? Because you can't get somewhere quickly unless you fly a plane, and you can't get there. I mean, you would have to mix with the public if you decided to take go to the airport. And if you're at the airport, you're just going to cause a scene. I mean, you're seriously going to cause a scene at the airport.
Yeah.
So I agree that it's weird. I don't know what to say about it. Right. Like there's some things that I guess you have to do, even if you're against the
sure. But like the issue that I read about 2 weeks ago was that she was in New York and her jet was in Nashville, and she flew her jet empty to New York so that she could then take it to Kansas City for a football game. The idea being she could have just rented another private jet in New York and flown to Kansas City.
Right. There's a lot of frivolous travel.
And anyway, I just made a rule to my wife. We're not looking up to anybody anymore.
No, you really shouldn't.
It's a good rule. It's a very good rule. I think we're all hypocrites. I think every last one of us is a hypocrite in one way or another. And it's hard to be consistent with our own selfish motives and humanity and all that kind of stuff.
You can be a hypocrite on accident. You can be a hypocrite out of ignorance. I'm talking about people being assholes.
It's hard to find that line though. Where does it cross over? Where does our own humanity cross over into intentional? There are some things there are many things you could say where all three of us would be like, yeah, that person's terrible. That's a terrible decision that person made. But then it kind of that needle starts to go down, and I don't know. I think we all have a way of defining our own narratives.
Well, that's a slightly different point than the one I would make, but it's not a wrong point. I don't think anybody's all good or all evil. I think we're all great.
Right.
But you're talking a little bit more about language and narrative, and I think that's we all see the world through our own. Like, it's impossible to see it through somebody else's eyes. We can only see the world through our eyes.
Right. Yeah.
And so, like, the Timberlake thing bothers me, but I guess in his eyes, after the Britney memoir came out and he laid low for 6 months, he assumed that was done. And now that he's come up with new music and it's all blown up again, he seems pissy about it. And so from my perspective, I'm like, read the room. But from his perspective, I don't know how he's been feeling for the last 6 months, because he was dragged over the coals for how Britney was treated after their relationship, in part because he made a song that seemed to be about her cheating on him. And I think he needs to take responsibility for that. But it feels like some people want to punish him for the way the patriarchal media treated both of them after that relationship. And maybe he owns some of that too. Maybe all of us men do. But it's murky. It's murky,
well, and man. He also got away scot-free after the Janet Jackson thing too. I mean, it's just, he's gonna do Janet a bunch of heinous shit, and he would just be like,
again, FKT! Though, is it his fault that Janet's career was ended after that and his wasn't?
It's I'm not saying his fault though, okay, but she's the only one who got in trouble for it. And it is more about the gatekeepers or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I hate the term gatekeeper now, because it's been fucking co-opted by assholes.
every term eventually is.
Every time there's a very good word to use for something, some dickhead faction of the internet takes it, and suddenly it's because now when you say it, you sound like one of those dickheads. It pisses me off.
Yes.
But yes, the media at large at the time and whoever else back then is more responsible there. Yes, that's not a comment on Justin Timberlake, It's more of a comment on the media at large at that point.
Yeah, so I can see it being tough for him, because at first there was that Britney documentary, and then her memoir came out a couple of years later, and there's been like a 2-year cycle of people being mad at him, some people being mad at him. But again, I certainly don't know all the evidence, but I don't remember much from back in the day that makes him the devil in terms of how he acted after they broke up.
I think the best we can say in those kind of situations is, I hope I would have acted this way, right? Like, like if we think of ourselves in those terms and go, okay, if I was in that situation, I hope I would have stood up for this or done this differently or those kind of things. I think we get into a little bit of an issue with blame. We all love we love the idea of judgment or blame, the idea of like looking at someone's actions and going, oh, here's how I morally paint those actions from this person, instead of going, here's what I can learn from that. Here's how I be a better person. You know, that's the shift I try to make, just because there's so much judgment to pass around, and I just don't have time to.
It just feels weird to me. I should stop talking. The murky conversation. It's not really a single topic happening here.
Tangentially to that, there's also the narrative that people come up with on their own outside of what actually happens and everything. Yes. Like, back in, I don't know how many years ago it was, I still thought this way, but, you know, you'd hear a celebrity say, well, this was taken out of context, or this was blah, 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 whatever. Now, I think 50% of the time they're just saving face, but the other 50% of the time, there is an out of context situation going on that somebody took a thing and then ran their own narrative with it. I remember something, I don't remember something in our past a few years ago, whatever, where somebody was like, well, apparently Jeremy's just as bad a person behind the scenes as he is on his videos and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, where did you come up with that narrative? I don't understand where that came from. How did you, I fear sometimes that we've interacted with somebody and we came off a certain way, and then they went, but we haven't interacted with that many people. That's what kills me. And I just wonder how far that goes when the more and more famous you become, like when you're at Taylor Swift stage or whatever. Yeah,
okay. So I've talked about this before, but I used to live in the town where she went to high school, and you ask anybody in that town that went to high school with her, and they all have bad things to say. And I'm convinced it's because she's a super famous billionaire megastar and they are not.
Yeah, right.